I would like to, let's give a hand to Sally Ann Ashton and Syra Law and Steve Quirk for hosting these. I think it's very important. I think it's considering that they're members of the Academy in a particular way. They're standard academics. The fact that they have opened their eyes and ears and hearts to having wider discussions sets them apart, so they're special people. I also want to recognize Professor Dr. Paulo Farias, who is from Brazil, sitting right here. He is an Africanist historian. He works on Islamic West African history. He was trained as a doctor, medical doctor first, but he's written beautiful books on, for example, Arabic inscriptions on tombs from Timbuktu and Jenné. He's a treasure. He's right here. He's at the University of Birmingham. He surprised me by coming today. He's a friend, an email friend, but now a personal friend. And so I think he's somebody that we all should get to know better and to speak with. Okay? All right, the biocultural origins of Egypt. Biocultural is a term that's used by many people in anthropology today to refer to synthesizing information about populations, about peoples, about communities. Biology by itself won't give you the answer. Culture won't give you the answer in many situations. Language won't give you the answer totally. The lines of evidence, though, should not be assumed to run together, to be necessarily collected, because we can speak, we can learn to speak different languages no matter who we are. We have Dr. Okamura here, who's a Brazilian also, but she's a, I think she's of Japanese origin, is that right? So here we go. And needless to say, we know that we have different ways to put things together. However, we can look at different parallel lines of evidence or different lines of evidence to see if they run parallel. That's what I mean to say. And that's what we're going to do with Egypt. Origins of early Egypt, you know, in sort of everyday terms. People want Asian, European, or African. These are very big terms which in themselves are might have problems. And when we talk about origins, we can talk about things long ago or more recent origins. And what do we mean? Well, we're talking about ancient Egypt. When we say origins, are we talking about the origins of the Egyptian state? You know, when they developed kings and a recognizable Egypt? Or are we talking about its more distant roots, where we can't identify anything that's necessarily Egyptian in the sense of the whole complex, the whole unit, but elements that surely went into it? What does origins mean? Are we talking about geography, language, culture, biological genealogy, or, in big quotes, this notion of race? And if I have a moment later on, I will talk about the issues with the problems with the concept of race. For me, let me just say this. Modern human beings do not structure into races. We use this word race very loosely and incorrectly. It has a technical meaning, and I insist on its technical meaning. I insist on that. We'll talk about it later. We want to explore objective criteria. And when we talk about geography, as I mentioned earlier, you can talk about physical geography, the location of a place, culture geography. We already talked about this. You know, Egypt is the gift of the Nile. And here we have a cross-section of the Nile Valley. We have the river here. And let me see if I can get this in focus. We have the floodplain. This is where most of Egyptian life took place, just up here and near the floodplain, because this is where food came from. And we have the low terraces in the desert. This is sort of the topography, a slice through the Nile Valley. And like I said earlier, we have the issue of understanding how the environment was used to create the culture, or what elements from the environment comment on the origins of the culture. There is no evidence that something called the Egyptian community or Egyptian culture was created in Syria and that a whole community of people came to the Nile Valley. Do things like that happen? Sure they do. The pilgrims came to America, and they came with notions of, you know, Protestantism, Magna Carta, etc., 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 clearly formed in England. They didn't like the king, but everything else they brought. They brought British culture to the New World. Here we have a language map of Africa. Language is also a part of culture. It's part of this origins questions. The top part of the map with the vertical crosshatches and the different lines represent the Afro-Asiatic language family. This is not all of the families now. There's some new families and some new members of the family. This is an old slide. Omotic, which is spoken only in southern Ethiopia, down in here. And there's another language, it's a dead language, called Ongata, spoken only by less than 10 people now, which is also felt to be a member of Afro-Asiatic. All right. This obviously doesn't have ancient Egyptian on it, because the reason we have Semitic in North Africa across what I call Super-Saharan Africa is because of during the Islamic period, Arabic was adopted by people. And in some cases, you had groups of Arabs who actually came into North Africa, such as the Hilalian invasion in the 11th century. No, in the 12th century. Oh, and the other language families of interest in this area would be the Nilo-Saharan language family. Modern Nubians speak Nilo-Saharan. You find Nilo-Saharan languages spoken in Ethiopia, across the belt through Darfur. The fur language itself is Nilo-Saharan. And you have Nilo-Saharan speakers along the bend of the Niger River, as well as in East Africa. The Songhai in West Africa speak Nilo-Saharan language. They're almost an isolate there, kind of here by themselves. Another interesting story in deep time African history. And people like the Maasai and the southern Sudanese also speak the Nilo-Saharan languages. Okay. Ancient Egypt, old and new, spoken Afro-Asiatic language, ancient Egyptian, sometimes called Afrasan by Chris Arrett, or Afrasian by the Russians, by Dakhanov. Nubian, Nilo-Saharan. In the Sahara, we have both Afro-Asiatic and Nilo-Saharan languages, and in the Sudan today, we have both languages spoken as well. This is one notion of how these languages may be connected genealogically. This is Roger Blench, who actually lives right here in Cambridge. This is a tree that he published. In this, he has Semitic languages spoken in the Near East, splitting off early. He suggested there may be an Erythraic group, that Egyptian Berber Chadic, spoken around Lake Chad and northern Nigeria, but also in other parts of the Sahara. Beja, spoken in the Sudan and Egypt even today, and Cushitic languages. This gets revised often. Here you have a picture from the great Russian linguist Dakhanov, Igor Dakhanov, who died a few years ago. This is from his book Afrasian Languages, published in 1965. He has the family of Afro-Asiatic originating near the Horn of Africa, either in the Southern Sahara, the Sudan, or some people say in Ethiopia proper. He has a Semitic branch going in across the Red Sea into Arabia. Other people have it going in through the north. Historical linguistics is a very interesting field that's still under development. Now, you can't look at this and assume that you had a bunch of people line up and say, okay, today we're all going to march out from the Horn of Africa and we're going to split up. This is just a sort of a schematic. Don't think of it that people, you know, got together and say, okay, we're going to split up now. It doesn't quite work that way. We're not going to talk about it. But this is a way to conceptualize the cradle land of the family and the fact that its daughters emerge out of a group of what's called dialect clusters that would have been there But don't think of something called Egyptian sort of coming into being right here and marching up, or Semitic being formed. Although there is one linguist who does think that Semitic actually emerged in the Horn. That's a minority opinion of one, Grover Hudson. But he does believe that based on the age of, or the amount of diversity in the Semitic languages in the Horn of Africa. Okay. We're in Cambridge, so we'll have to mention Colin Renfrew. The Nostratic hypothesis was developed by Dolgopolsky and some other Russian linguists. Basically, they argue that Indo-European, Afro-Asiatic, Altaic, and Indo-Dravidian are all related, and that the cradle land for them was in Anatolia, parts of southern Europe, and that they broke off and spread with agriculture. This idea has not won wide acceptance by anybody who knows anything about it. Let me just say that. I don't mean to be rude. The Nostratic hypothesis is not well supported by linguistic evidence. The further you go back in time, the more likely it is that you're going to get accidental resemblances. Also, Proto-Afro-Asiatic, Mother Afro-Asiatic, was spoken by not agriculturalists, but by hunters and gatherers. So, and the genetic data will not conform to this tree, although it may conform to the northern part of this tree to some degree. It doesn't work in the case of Afro-Asiatic. But you should know that there are people who advocate for this perspective. And they treat all of these subgroups as daughter languages of a mother Afro-Asiatic. However, with regard to Afro-Asiatic, there seems to be a growing consensus that this family is related to Nostratic as a sister language rather than as a daughter, as Greenberg and Harold Fleming had already proposed. So there are other people who do accept the Nostratic hypothesis, but they don't see Afro-Asiatic as a daughter of Nostratic. They see it as a sister, which means that there would be a mother or a father of both Afro-Asiatic and the Nostratic groupings. That you could probably make work, and you would make it work by going way back in time, and you would basically say that when you had the Out of Africa movement, that the people who left, a people, at least the northern part of the world, left from a region, say in Northeast Africa, and that the people who were left are the people who wound up speaking Afro-Asiatic, and that'll work. You know, but in general, those long-distance linguistic hypotheses with the deep-time reconstructions don't conform to what most historical linguists think is scientifically provable or valid. And so there are only a handful of people who are engaged in that. Now, in terms of geography, again, we want to have a setting for our culture. And this map illustrates that between 8,000 and 9,000 years ago, the rains had returned to Africa, so to speak, and the lake levels were all high. We had Lake Mega Chad. There were rivers running the Sahara this way, and it is at this moment in time that we see people moving back into the Sahara. In fact, there are not a lot of sites in the Nile Valley at this time, and the people who were in the Sahara when conditions get worse eventually move into the valley. So when we look at the pre-dynastic cultures of early Egypt, we see influences from the Sahara. We have Levantine influences, as I mentioned, you know, sheep, goat, cattle, the animals that were domesticated. They actually wind up in the Sahara before they are in the Nile Valley. We find evidence in some cases for example, goats and goat remains. We think they're goat remains. In terms of the early pre-dynastic, there's a culture called the Tazian, which people have generally put together with the Bedarian. But the Tazian has a particular kind of beaker, tulip shape, that has its ancestry, clearly seems to have originated in the Sudan, up and down the Nile Valley from the Neolithic, but probably ultimately of Saharan origin, and not found in the Near East, are these slate palettes. And I don't have any slides of those that I'm going to show today, but just go down to the Petrie Museum in London and you can see some beautiful ones from the Bedarian and the Nakata periods. So here we have this slide made from an article published in 2006 in Science that's entitled, and I recommend that you read it, it's about the climate-driven occupation of the Western Sahara. And the authors basically say that this was a major factor in early African history. These are sites for which we have good archaeological material indicating some sort of settlements. And then when we go 1,000 years later, we have very few sites here, but we have all of these sites along the Nile Valley. And the toolkits and the pottery in the Nile Valley represent a coherent mixing of the hunting-gathering traditions in the Nile Valley with the traditions from the Sahara. And as I said, with some things, influences from the Sudan in early Egypt. This is more artistic. I normally don't do art, but just to show you, this is from Otoori, who's a Basque Egyptologist. And in this, in this particular article, what he's trying to show is that we can sort of, quote, read Saharan paintings, and we can see similar motifs in early Egyptian art. So you have in early Saharan paintings, you have men with elephants. You don't normally think of elephants being in the Eastern Sahara, but they were there at one time. This motif, men, did he really actually, it's hard to believe the giraffes would let you do this to them, but anyway, it's there. And we see these motifs in Egyptian art. Now, some people have argued that this sort of motif, taming of the two beasts, is actually of Near Eastern origin. Well, okay, let's take the compromise position and say that you may have had traditions of the taming of the wild beast from multiple sources. But nevertheless, you do see it in the Sahara, and in the Sahara, it's older than it is in Egypt or Mesopotamia. This deformation of cattle horns, still seen in southern Sudan today, was also practiced in the Sahara, and in this rather late depiction of a cow in ancient Egypt, we see this same practice going on. Here are some more things, again, certain similarities from the Saharan art seen also in Egyptian art. So again, this is just to talk about an archaeological connection of regions in Africa and the surrounding areas being connected to the Nile Valley. We've already talked about language as well. Now, physical anthropology is what everybody thinks that biology tells you everything. I'm here to tell you it doesn't. But since many of us believe it does, we're going to talk about it. The problem with previous work in general is that they were based on what I call race models, and all the traditional racial studies are deductive. That is to say, they assume that you have some, quote, racial types, well-defined anatomical complexes, sets of physical traits, such that whenever you see an individual who doesn't fit either one, your explanation is that they must be a mixture of the two extremes, okay? Now, of course, we see people in real life who have one parent from one place and one parent from another place, so it's quite possible that, you know, so we have actually seen people who are that way. But the question is that the explanation in all places and for all times? Well, if you believe that, then you leave Darwin out of the picture. You believe a notion of evolution and other kinds of processes out. So one type of study works from a presumption of groups that mix. The other kind of study takes a little bit different point of view, and it's usually involves mathematics, whereby you measure up something, you submit it to the computer and see where things cluster or where they group. That always is not foolproof either, because you need a model. You need a model. So you ground your discussion, from my point of view, and talking about African diversity, okay? And these are the different sub-areas of human biology that have been useful: skeletal biology, serogenetics, DNA, that all feed into us being able to talk about population diversity and origins. As I've said earlier, I believe that you have to use archaeology, linguistics, and history. You have to talk about populations versus what are called typological studies. You have to be willing to talk about your methodology and whether or not just because you measure it and you get results from the computer, that this is easily interpretable without a model. You have to talk about the history, the sociology of knowledge. That is to say, are the facts determined by people in power? You have to talk about history of ideas. And we want to talk about phenotype versus descent. Now, the easiest way to talk about this is to understand that in this little diagram here, think of this as an ancestral tree, and you've got A and B and C as the descendants from some ancestors here. And this similarity is a similarity, it refers to how closely they resemble each other. And this word descent here actually refers to where they're connected. A, B, and C are equally similar, but B and C are more recently connected in terms of ancestry. Okay? Now, there's a lot of technical language around this, which you know, we can talk about later, but this is very, very important because there are different populations in the world that look very similar to each other, but they're not closely related when you do genealogy and DNA. There are people in New Guinea, and I'll just use this as an example, in islands in Oceania, who, to the average eye, to the typical eye, and we talk about this, oh, they look like Africans. But when you do a genealogical study with DNA on them, they are Asians, okay? They belong right where they are. And then there's some people in Africa who don't look like each other, who are genealogically more closely connected, okay? Depending on what kind of data you use, this uses traditional blood groups, you know, ABO, your blood type, and proteins in your blood, and then they did an analysis and they got clustering. And when they did it this way with the blood groups, they had the Africans and the Europeans were more similar to each other, and the people from Australia and North America and India were more similar to each other based on these genetic characters from the blood. But when they did cranial studies, they found that people from Papua New Guinea and the Australian Aborigines and certain Africans clustered together, and people from North America and Chinese, Japanese, people from Asia, Polynesia, that they clustered together. Now, which one is the truth? This is some old data. I see people looking. These are studies that were done when many people here were probably quite small. But anyway, there was a conflict here. There's a conflict here. All of this is science. All of this is science. This is blood groups, you know, blood type, you know, proteins in the blood. And these are studies from the skeleton. The computer generated both of them. The data are real. Which one tells the truth? I put this up here to just let you know that you probably always need a model of interpretation based on wider sets of data. And in the current era, it's probably true that the DNA sequence data for certain markers will give you a tree that's different from both of these. And that you need a model rooted in concepts about African diversity to really understand it. Okay? Now, when it comes to Egypt, there's been a lot of previous work, some of it done right here on the Cambridge Collection. Very famous study, Mukherjee et al., 1955, with Professor Trevor, who was here at Cambridge Department of Physical Anthropology. Overall, if you looked at all of these studies, none of these studies will actually show or suggest, with the exception of a few, that the Nile Valley people, called the Egyptians, were from any place else but Northeast Africa. Okay? There are other studies done with dental work, and limb ratio. We talked about tropical body plan. And this is what I mean when you talk about in the state of our current knowledge, we have to understand there's a long presence of modern people in Africa. The coalescence times, the times to which you get to a common ancestor for many molecules, is so old that it generally places many of them in Africa, but not all of them. We have fossils all over in Africa, in Algeria at 60,000 years BP, but we have other fossils that have been dated that are essentially modern humans to around 190,000 years ago. The northeast quadrant of Africa seems to contain a subset of wider variation in Africa, and maybe the rest of the world contains a subset of this. In Africa, you have different ecozones, different demographic histories, and therefore we should expect a large amount of variability. Now, the methods that have generally been used, especially on skeletons, include these different methods that are involved. In one case, just looking at aspects of the anatomy, we call that a morphological approach. Not commonly used anymore, but in the past it was quite common. Now we use these other statistics that are usually based on measurements. Okay, some are more valid than others, we believe, from a mathematical point of view. Although sometimes you get very similar results no matter what you do. This is a human skull, and these characteristics that are shown here are called non-metric traits or traits. And these are just basically anatomical variations. These traits are sometimes called epigenetic, and many people believe that, at least for certain circumstances, that using these traits are sort of like using DNA from the skeleton. My own opinion about any of this kind of research is that at a certain level, in local and restricted time frames and in local areas, I think that these methods are very valuable. When you start doing global things, you have to be very careful about your traits. You're going to get some parallel examples of what might be called groupings based on parallel evolution, like we saw with the Australians and New Guineans clustering together with certain Africans. In Egypt, we have, as I said, a long history of human habitation. Not a lot of fossils, but things going back to 55,000 years ago, which according to some geneticists is before the period of time that modern humans left Africa, at least through the northern exit. So we've had people there. So any idea that you had to populate Egypt from the Near East even 50, 60,000 years ago is not necessary. There have always been migrations back and forth, but to explain Super-Saharan Africa, as I like to say, based on migrations from Eurasia is not well-founded. The Nazlik-Cotter specimen that I just mentioned here before, in one study by Gunter Brauer, plotted in a multi-discriminant analysis, plots with, quote, modern sub-Saharan Africans, but very near the line. I'm suspect of doing certain things with old specimens in this manner, but nevertheless, and in another study using a different set of variables, we see overlap in multiple directions. Number one, there's a lot of overlap in the middle. That's an important thing to understand. The crania from Dar es Sultan 5 dates around 60,000 years ago. It has clustered with a group of Upper Paleolithic European skulls, as well as overlapping with North Africa. Only problem with 60,000 years ago and these Upper Paleolithic skulls, I mean, what's the problem with that? Let me ask you. They have material from Upper Paleolithic Europe, and they have this Dar es Sultan cranium or partial cranium, which is probably about 60,000 years old, and it's clustering with the Upper Paleolithic Europeans. So does that mean that it came from Europe? That would be our reflex, right? Does it mean? You can talk.
No.
Why not?
Because, you know, if it came out of Africa.
Huh?
If it came out of Africa.
Well, no, but I want you to answer this a very specific way. We have Upper Paleolithic European material, and we have this specimen that's 60,000 years old and from North Africa, and it's clustering, it's grouping with Upper Paleolithic Europeans. So did it come from Upper Paleolithic means modern people, but the rest of these specimens, I can tell you in this study, came from Europe. So does it mean that Dar es Sultan came from Europe? It's clustering with them.
Well,
Come on, we got Cambridge students here, right? PhD, master students, somebody. Oh, no, people are shaking their head. Oh, good. There were no modern people in Europe 60,000 years ago. There were no modern people in Europe 60,000 years ago. So the fact that it clusters with them cannot be used, naive way, to say that it came from Europe, because there was nobody in Europe for it to come from. The issue of when similarity means genealogy is always the issue in these kinds of studies. I don't care what the data are, with the possible exception of certain kinds of Y chromosome data and the mitochondrial DNA from women. Now, when it comes to Egyptian crania, the kinds of descriptions that used to be used, in early days, good Brits, Cambridge, Oxford guys, talked about the pre-dynastic race of Egypt. They say, and in the main, a blending of various proportion of Semite and Negro. And this is from an old book, The Earliest Inhabitants of Abydos. Well, what's very interesting about that is that this is from a typological perspective. You get something that's in the middle that seems to have different traits. Well, I would argue, no, it's not a blending of anything. It's just own people that, from a biogeographical perspective, evolved right there in Northeast Africa. But this is what happens when you have a preconception about human variation being digitalized. So when you see something in the middle, a long time ago, you assume that it has to be the result of certain kind of mixture. Sometimes this might be true, but you can't prove it in a case like this, And then another study more recently from Eugene Struhal talked about the Bedarian crania showed mixed, quote, racial traits. Depending on how you analyze the Bedarian series, they will cluster with tropical Africans, or they will cluster with other Northeast Africans, Sub-Saharan Africans. If you use a big database and you put extreme variants in it, they'll cluster in a group with Northeast Africans, and that whole cluster will cluster with Europeans. If you use another set of variables, you'll get them, the Northeast Africans, clustering out, and the Europeans will cluster over here, and the other Africans will cluster over there. Again, the issue is understanding your methods. This is from the Mukherjee, Rao, and Trevor study that I mentioned. This is just a plot from this book, from their book, actually. And what we see is that these early Egyptian and Nubians clustering with each other. New Kingdom Nubians, C group, A group, Kerma. We see the Bedarians down here. And they have this other series called Egyptian Negroes of Dynastic Age. And I'm still not clear on where that came from. And then you have some late dynasty Egyptians from the north, from Giza, and ninth dynasty, grouping on the other side. But here you have this cluster of Nubians in the middle, okay? All right. Here's another example. Same study, only I took their data and ran it again, but get a similar picture. Okay, I've been told that I've got time. There's another study done by someone in France. Northwest African material, Saharan material, something from Mali in West Africa, and the Bedarian over here, again showing an intersection of this material. Another study actually shows the same thing. Let me just show you this real quickly. Material from Giza, from Nubia, Nakata, all Egyptian sites, clustering in with some material, some old material from East Africa here and down here. But the point here that I want to make is, for those who want to say that there's no overlap in the metric characteristics of early Egyptians and other Africans, it's not true based on this study. Otherwise, they should have been clustering outside all by themselves, and they don't do that, okay? When we talk about it. Here's a W.W. Howes' study. Clustering with a technique called successive mergers. You take the two most similar, and then you add, and then you add, and then you add. In this case, the late dynastic Egyptian series clusters with Europeans. Then when you use another method, clustering by successive splits, where you look at the whole group, I got 20 oranges, and I say, how can I divide them in half? So the computer divides them in half and then subdivides them. In this case, the Egyptians cluster with the other Africans and some other tropical people, Andaman Islanders, from there. Here's a study that I did, 19 variables, which I happen to think is pretty good. The Giza stuff still clusters with Europeans. Northern Delta Egyptians doesn't surprise me. But the Kerma Nubians, the Somali, the Bedarian form a group together, some Khoisan, and they form together a secondary cluster with Teta and Dogon, with other Africans, in other words. This little thing is called a septal aperture. It's felt to be a genetic trait. When you do an analysis of frequencies on this trait, you find out the Bedarians, 50% of the individuals, and it's a very small sample here, had at least one of these septal apertures. From Cargoaces during the Coptic period, 55%. Other Egyptians from Lisht, it should be Lisht, 45, 43%. The Somali, 52%. Japanese, Ainu, 11 to 15%. Quote-unquote American Negroes, you can tell this is from an old paper, 18%. Whites born in the USA, 5.2%. Anyway, what this is saying, the Northeast Africans and North Africans have a high percentage of this septal aperture, Wadi Halfa, Jebel Sahaba, and also the material that Allison Brooks found down in Zaire that's 25,000 years old. Almost all of the individuals have it, too. The length, the ratio of the upper, the distal segment of the upper limb to the upper limb, thought to be related to a tropical body plan. We see the Bedarians here, the median value is 0.78, sort of in this whole middle of things. But even interestingly enough, Algerians from earlier periods have very elongated limbs along with the Somali. I was surprised by that myself. Some DNA stuff that we all love. This is a particular haplotype. We can talk about it later. But if you look at Egypt, Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, Egypt, and Libya, you just need to know that this 4th, 5, and 11 are haplotypes that are common in Northeast Africa and other parts of Africa. You see a certain percentage in Egypt, but the 7 and 8 are more common, as you see in Lebanon, Palestine, and Iraq. So Egypt, once again, even the modern population is grounded in Northeast Africa. Okay, I'm being told. This is the actual family tree here. What's important about this is one thing I want to say, and then I'm going to stop. This is uniparentally inherited. This is a Y chromosome passed from father to son, son to son. This particular DNA marker here, PN2, is sort of the background, and that's what this means, it's the background of 73% of all of the peoples in Africa today. 73%. The PN2 is found in West Africa and sub-equatorial Africa. The P2 or M2 is as it's called. This M35, 215 M35, is what you find in the Horn of Africa up to Egypt and over to Morocco. It corresponds to the 5 and the 11 in the previous slide. This is the father of both groups of Africans. This binds the continent together, okay? So although you have Berbers with blue eyes and blonde hair, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they share, for the most part, this PN2 ancestry with people in West and tropical Africa. This is the modern population. And they share much less of the M89, which comes off the tree, in another way. I'm going to finish here. This is an old slide. I'll just stop here. Okay, well, that's where it stopped anyway, doesn't it? Okay. All right.
Any questions about Shamarka's presentation? Okay.
You mentioned about there being no Europeans 60,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
Can you tell me when they first went into Egypt? When the Mediterranean people first went into Egypt?
When I talk about 60,000 years ago, there being no modern people in Europe, what I'm saying is the best evidence that we have for modern people being anatomically, what we call modern, anatomically modern people in any part of Europe is at the outside 40,000 years, okay? And when you talk about Mediterranean people, we need to talk about that later on because, as I have said and tried to say, Africans don't all look alike. So some of what you're calling Mediterranean people are just some more Africans. Okay? Now, you have to get your arms around that. And that's what that last slide was about with the PN2 transition. Because most of the people there who have that PN2 transition, that particular gene, that genealogy, in its derived form is M35. For example, Berbers are M35, M81. Those people don't look like Congolese. But I'm trying to have you understand that they are carrying genealogically, in terms of their male ancestry at least, they're carrying something that ties them to the rest of the continent and does not tie them to Europe, even though physically, externally, you may say, well, gee, they look like Europeans. You understand what I'm saying? So when you ask me, when did X, we don't use those concepts of Mediterranean race, Alpine race, Nordic, all that, that's from another era. You know, there, it's descriptive, and in actual fact, you will find, you can find individuals all over the world who might conform to one of those sort of categories. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. So then, that's so, the same thing they say about being Arab. Arab is a culture, not a race. It means traveling person.
Okay, but I'm trying to understand what are you asking me here? Well, you ask me very specifically. You ask me when did Mediterranean people get to Egypt? I don't know what you mean by Mediterranean. But let me repeat
that
myself.
Don't look African.
No, well, there's more than one way to be African. There's more than one way to look African. There's more than one way to look Asian. There's more than one way to be Asian. That is what you have to, from my perspective as an evolutionary biologist, that's what you have to get your arms around. The people in southern India are just as Asian as the people in northern China, who are just as Asian and the people from as Asian as the people from the Eurasian steppes. You know, they don't look alike. And you measure them, they don't look alike.
Okay. Yeah. Let me put it another way. For example, you have Elizabeth Taylor playing Cleopatra.
Okay.
That's what I'm talking about.
Well, what do you mean? What are you talking about?
When did that sort of look enter Egypt?
The thing is that, number one, who was Cleopatra?
I'm asking you.
Well, what I'm saying, Cleopatra was probably a Macedonian. Well, she was a Macedonian.
From near Greece.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. When did people that look like that go into Egypt?
Well, I don't know about Elizabeth Taylor specifically, and, you know, very specifically, but I would dare to say that within the Nile Valley, within the Nile Quarter, within Super-Saharan Africa, there have always been people who were lighter skin and straighter haired from 60,000 years ago. Always. They're not new. That's my whole point. In fact, I could make the argument that those kinds of characteristics actually originated in Africa.
Yeah,
that they didn't come from someplace else.
Yeah.
They're part of modern humanity, or they're part of humanity. And there's no reason to believe that they could not have originated in Africa. Incidentally, skin color can flip back and forth from an evolutionary point of view, we now know, every 15,000 or so years. It's not the sort of thing that, you know, it takes 100,000 years, million years to live in one place. And skin color itself is not always an accurate index, even in current situations like in Brazil and Venezuela. It doesn't necessarily give you a proportionate amount of ancestry. You can have people with very fair skin, but actually have more quote-unquote black ancestors than some people who are actually darker. So you have to be very careful about what you think you can quantify from that, again, based on science evidence. Now, the issue of having narrow features, a narrow face, and what have you, we have remains, and normally I would show you this slide, but we're not going to get to that today, of people from Gamble's Cave in East Africa down in Kenya that are probably about 10 to 12,000 years old. If you measure them up and submit them to a forensic type analysis, they'll cluster with Europeans. They're not Europeans. Their limb ratios are as tropical as you can be. They come from right there. That's what you have to get your
own. Charlie, you could ask more questions later. I'd like to give somebody else a chance, and you can carry on later, yeah? Anybody else? Okay, we need to stop. Oh, okay, sorry, yeah.
I mean, you place stock in Darwin's theory of evolution, and I'm just trying to get an idea from what the questions I'm hearing is. I mean, what would you define then as an African?
I don't define an African or the African. There is a matrix of variability that constitutes a description of an African reality. Very different notion. The moment you start defining things with narrow terms, and in particular ways, and a non-scientific, for something that's as fluid as this, is the moment that you will get into trouble, because then you're going to be forced to explain things, like I said, with typological methods or deductive methods when they don't fit. Okay?
It's a shame we ran out of time for this section, because that would have been really fascinating. It's just that you said there's and I do hear your point, there's a diversity within the African identity or spectrum. It just feels that if there is no... I mean, we don't just need to talk about the African identity. I mean, I don't subscribe to the notion of race either. But I think if we're using terms like African or Egyptian, which is probably more geopolitical in that context. But if we're using terms like that to define a reality, surely there must be a boundary. Also, it isn't diversity we're talking about. We're talking about an entirety of the human race, which is one. And then we start to lose...
No, you don't lose
Where's
it because you have...
Where's the barriers for the diversity?
No, you don't lose anything because you have your model-based approach. You have a real history of a species that emerged in Africa. You have some real fossils. You have some real people that you can look at. You have some real DNA evidence that ties together. Frankly, I was quite astounded when I found when the Y chromosome data got produced. They didn't have that 25 years ago when I first started on this adventure. But I am pleased to say that I wrote, and you can get my master's thesis, I said, there's no theoretical reason why these Berbers from Algeria couldn't be, have share common ancestors in the late Pleistocene. And sure enough, 20 years later, when the DNA came out, because what most people would say is they look at these Berbers, and I have pictures of them, they say, oh, these are descendants of the Vandals, because they look like Europeans. Well, I'm trying to have you understand that God or evolution, whichever one you want to choose to work with, works in mysterious ways. And I'm trying to have you understand that from a scientific point of view, that PN2 marker, that PN2 gene, ties 70% of the continent together. And there's some other things that are basically only restricted to Africa, except for the odd one you find outside, groups A and B. This belong to the E group. We can talk about that later. But no, what you're saying is that if you don't have some hard and fast boundaries, then it's hard for you to work with certain things. And I'm saying that would be like saying that if your son, if you had six sons and one of them moved to China and his descendants were only Chinese, and one moved to Greenland and his descendants were only Inuit, and another son moved to, I don't know, the Amazon and his descendants were only, you know, folks from the Amazon, that they wouldn't be your relatives. That would not patently be not true. Genealogically, they would all be connected to you because you're the grandpa. They're still connected. The idea that physical similarity will always track with relationship is what we're trying to get. I'm trying to dispel you of that notion because it's not always true. And so there's sometimes people who may look very similar or when you measure certain things, they may appear to be similar based on the math, but in actual fact, using other measures and other kinds of information, you know that can't possibly be true. You know, so when I go down to when I go to some village in the Sudan and I say that guy looks just like guy at the conference in London, I mean they must be. Oh, no, it's not your twin brother. You know, it's an accident. It's an accident. There is something in physical anthropology and evolutionary biology called polytopicity. And polytopicity was a problem for early evolutionary biologists who were interested in taxonomy and classification. Why? Because polytopicity refers to the fact that you have similar-looking groups of organisms, or you have a group of organisms in one place that looks very similar to another group of organisms in another in terms of whether it was their wing shape, their morphology, in terms of things that you can measure. But the dilemma was, should you group these things together when one was 10,000 miles away from the other and there was no way that one got from one place to the other? In other words, they were not closely historically connected. So it's called polytopicity. It's one of the problems with the subspecies concept for zoologists, and the subspecies concept in zoology is the same as the race idea for human beings. Only with human beings, there's even more problems than there were for the zoologists. Problem of classification. So my human example of polytopicity is certain people from Vanuatu and Papua New Guinea and those places who, for everybody who just sees them on the street, based on your own social experience, you say, these look like Africans. These are Africans. Well, no, they're not. No, they're not. Their lineage DNA says they're not. Where they live says they're not. And their languages definitely put them very far afield. But they live in tropical climates. Modern humans were tropical to begin with. Are these retentions from early migrations? Or are they just reacquisitions of tropical traits? Now, no one can answer that. but their DNA clearly ties them to Asia. I mean, the lineage DNA. And there's some other interesting things about DNA, too. Other markers, okay, other, and I have to finish now. Other markers clearly, in terms of lines of descent, tie together. Not just simply all of humanity. You can forget that there's some other more specific markers that tie people from China all the way to Africa together. And it's like amazing. That's the Yap marker. You know, and there used to be a debate, did the Yap marker arise in Africa or arise in Asia? If you say the Yap marker arose in Asia, then you're saying most of all Africans today came from Asia. Now, I know certain people don't want to hear that, you know, those who are ideologically oriented in particular ways. So no, you know, and but the proof, so to speak, is that, number one, that wasn't very logical based on the dates of the emergence of the Yap marker. But also, within Nigeria today, they found some people who have the Yap marker. Well, that's a long story, but anyway, it sort of submits that Africa is the place of origin for this particular marker. Okay.
At the time when the Homo sapiens first emerged from Africa, they were Negroes at that time.
What do you mean? No, I don't use that. No, I don't use that term, Negro.
Yeah, I don't mean that. I'm just trying to make a strong point. Were they black? Of a black race?
Well, in terms of their skin color, they would have been dark based on ecological principles. Based on principles, that's our guess. Do we have any empirical proof?
You could be dark and Asian, or you could be dark and black. That's what I'm saying. Sorry to use the word Negro, but at the time, would they have been Negroes coming out of Africa?
I don't know what you mean by Negro, and I wouldn't use that word. I wouldn't use that word. No.
Black man.
Yeah, well, if they... No, I will say that they were dark, and I don't know how dark. And they had limb ratios that are tropical, that you find in the tropics today. Okay? Those are all things that, from based on biological principles, would tie them to where they are. And most people, and most scientists would say, yes, they would have been dark. How dark, I can't tell you. They wouldn't have been blonde, no, if that's what you're asking. If that's the hidden question underneath, they wouldn't have been blonde.
In other words, they would have been African, from Africa, they would have been...
At that moment in time, you're talking about a species history. Okay.
We need to just wind down now. There's no more questions. You're welcome to talk to Shamarka with the coffee and teas. What I'd like to do is thank you for an excellent workshop. Really enjoyed that. I'm sure other people have, even if they might have been quiet. They were absorbing it all, I'm sure.
Okay,
so thank you, Shamarka.
Thank you. It was nice to be here.